Many of you are animal lovers, like myself, and have been asking me about what I feed the birds at the lake. So I decided to take you along for the ride. Let's go. It seems that all of the waterfowl enjoy seeds, but the swans and geese seem to like corn the best. So I make sure that there's plenty of kernels in the bag. Since antiquity, geese were seen as special. In ancient Egypt, the sun was sometimes regarded as an egg, laid daily by the celestial goose. The phoenix is said to have emerged from this egg. Sun gods, or pharaohs, were often depicted with geese, sometimes representing the soul. And when a new pharaoh was proclaimed, four wild geese were released to the four corners of the earth to tell the gods of the new earthly ruler. So the Egyptians saw the goose as a messenger between heaven and earth, as did the ancient Chinese, who perceived the geese as heavenly messengers, and a common symbol in ancient religious poems of Xi Qing, dated to the 7th century BC, usually concerning eroticism and sacred sexuality. Of course, I've already made a video about how Zeus disguised himself as a swan and would seduce, or rape, mortal women. But here at Lake Balboa, the birds certainly do think that they themselves are gods because of how spoiled they are. Even the little pigeons like to stop by, which brings us to today's episode. The species most commonly referred to as pigeon is the rock dove, one subspecies of which, the domestic pigeon, is common in many cities as the feral pigeon. Pigeons and doves are likely the most common birds in the world. They primarily feed on seeds, fruits, and plants, and here, on a park bench in Buenos Aires, we can see what happens when one decides to feed pigeons. You better be prepared, they are not exactly shy, and they have a seemingly unquenchable appetite. Pigeons have lived alongside man for thousands of years, with the first images of pigeons being found by archaeologists in Mesopotamia, or modern Iraq, dating back to about 3000 BC. It was the Sumerians in Mesopotamia that first started to breed white doves, from the wild pigeon that we see in our towns and cities today, and this undoubtedly accounts for the amazing variety of colors that are found in the average flock of urban pigeons. To ancient people, a white pigeon would have seemed miraculous, and this partially explains why the bird was widely worshipped and considered to be sacred. Throughout human history, the pigeon has adopted many roles, ranging from symbols of gods and goddesses, through to sacrificial victims, messengers, pets, food, and even war heroes. In both the First and Second World Wars, the pigeon saved hundreds of thousands of human lives by carrying messages across enemy lines. The first biblical reference to a pigeon was the story of Noah and the dove of peace. In the 16th, 17th, and 18th century in Europe, pigeon poop was a highly prized fertilizer and considered to be far more potent than farmyard manure. Speaking of manure, one of the richest and most famous families in the world amassed its wealth, certainly in part, as a result of exploiting the pigeon. In the early 1800s, the Rothschild family set up a network of pigeon lofts throughout Europe and used homing pigeons to carry information between its financial houses. This method proved to be quicker and more efficient than any other means of communication available at the time. The speed of the service, combined with the ability to send and receive information ahead of the competition, helped the Rothschild family to amass a fortune which still exists today. The humble pigeon has attracted some very famous fans over the last few thousand years, ranging from royalty to rock and roll singers and actors, through to fashion designers. One of the most famous royals is Queen Elizabeth of England, who has lofts and pigeon keepers at her estate in Norfolk. Elvis Presley had a soft spot for pigeons, and Mike Tyson is also an enthusiastic pigeon keeper. Even Maurizio Gucci, the international renowned fashion designer, is a keen pigeon fancier, spending a reputed $10,000 on one single American pigeon. Pigeons are considered to be one of the most intelligent birds on the planet, with pigeons being able to undertake tasks previously thought to be the sole preserve of humans and primates. The pigeon has also been found to pass the mirror test, being able to recognize its reflection in a mirror, and is one of only six species and the only non-mammal that has this ability, one of which is the dolphin. Please watch my video on that if you haven't already. The pigeon can also recognize all 26 letters of the English language, as well as being able to conceptualize. In scientific tests, pigeons have been found to be able to differentiate between photographs and even differentiate between two different human beings in a photograph, when rewarded with food for doing so, of course. Nikola Tesla is best known for his pioneering research in electricity and robotics, and for his numerous suppressed inventions which involve the potentials of free energy. He was unusually fond of pigeons. Lots of folks breed pigeons in the park, but Tesla didn't stop there. He used to find ailing pigeons and bring them back to his room. He lived in a hotel. Tesla had many pigeons. He fed and cared for them, but there was this one that he particularly was fond of. He described it as being a beautiful female bird, pure white with light gray tips on its wings. One night, the bird flew into Tesla's room at St. Regis Hotel, and he perceived that she was attempting to tell him that she was dying. Tesla said a light came from her eyes, more intense than he had ever produced by the most powerful lamps in his laboratories. The bird then died, and Tesla said that at that same moment, something went out of his life, and he knew his life's work was finished. Nikola Tesla died alone in his hotel room on January 7th, 1943. All of his possessions and personal files were confiscated by the U.S. government after his death, allegedly to stop them from falling into enemy hands. But what happened to them? I already made a video about Tesla's involvement in the Philadelphia experiment, a top secret project that attempted to give the Allied powers invisibility for the war effort. The technology associated with these experiments were said to have been able to manipulate space-time and was rumored to work on the same principles that allowed for anti-gravitic flight. Prior to his death, Tesla spoke of a death ray he was working on, which several nations were interested in, and so the FBI was sent in to secure his final work. As most people are aware by now, the man that last handled his belongings was none other than John Trump, the uncle of President Donald Trump.
When Nikola Tesla died suddenly in 1943 in a hotel room in New York, there was a lot of intrigue, since he was so brilliant and worked on so many important things like motors and x-rays. A lot of people were worried that his unreleased work would fall into the wrong hands. So the FBI got involved, and they just released 65 pages worth of documents surrounding that intrigue in response to a FOIA request from Muckrock. Apparently, Tesla's good friend Blois Fitzgerald told the FBI that Tesla told him that he had actually finished a revolutionary type of torpedo, which he hadn't told anyone about yet. And Fitzgerald said that Tesla also told him he completed a working model of a death ray and had hidden it in a lockbox in New York. Adding to the intrigue, Tesla had a relative he didn't like very much named Sava Kosanovich. Kasanovic was from Yugoslavia and had connections to the Axis powers, according to a New York Times source in the documents. And apparently, Kasanovic was at the hotel on the night of Tesla's death and searched the lockbox. He ended up taking a few pictures only, apparently, nothing major, but still, the intrigue swirled. So just to make sure they didn't miss out on Tesla's death ray, the FBI decided to have an expert thoroughly look over all the stuff Tesla had left behind. That expert was an MIT engineer who had worked with the government on stuff like radar research, so they trusted him. And that MIT engineer was none other than Donald Trump's uncle, John G. Trump. So Donald Trump's actual uncle was the person to inspect Tesla's supposed death ray machine. For real, you can't make that up. Now, to me, that's pretty funny. I mean, maybe that's why Trump's so confident when it comes to bragging about our military and bossing other countries around. Maybe his brilliant scientist uncle saw some secret plans of Tesla's that the president nephew now knows about.
The official story is that Trump's uncle did not find anything important. But given the media's habit of distorting the truth, especially in regards to wartime technology, many people questioned the validity of the official story. That said, here's a short clip of the events in John Trump's own words.
From New York, I boarded a plane to Boston to find Dr. John Trump of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Dr. Trump was now retired from the company he founded, High Voltage Engineering, but he agreed to meet me at the company office the next morning.
In the spring of 1943, Dr. Carl T. Compton, who was then president of MIT, asked me to go to New York and examine the effects of Nikola Tesla. These were contained in an upper floor of a warehouse somewhere in New York City. And I spent a good deal of time examining one by one the papers, the books, and various other memorials that he had accumulated. But I was particularly looking for something which would be evidence of a secret weapon, which I was reminded by the agents, the two agents who were present during the entire time, was a matter of concern to the United States. In the course of this, I did come across a number of letters directed at the upper echelon of the British Empire, that is, I think, to the King and Queen, or perhaps just to the King of England, and also to the Tsar of Russia, explaining that he was the inventor of a secret weapon which had rather remarkable properties, and that he would be interested in entering into a negotiation which would lead to a disclosure of what they were. Of course, I spent a good deal of time looking through these papers, trying to find out what the nature of this secret weapon was. I think I had, although I don't remember it so very accurately, an idea of what its properties were. It had the capability of acting at a great distance, of being destructive to flying objects and things of that kind at a place which was remote from the source. But nowhere in his technical papers did I find anything which revealed an explanation of just how such a device could operate.
I believe that you also opened another box, supposedly a secret weapon, that he left at another hotel. Can you relate that story, please?
Yes, when I had substantially concluded my study on the following day, I think that was a Saturday morning, I was reminded by one of the two agents that there was a box being held as a security for an unpaid obligation, and that this bell box was an item of considerable value and may indeed itself be the secret weapon, that it was armed and therefore it probably was not touched.
Were you nervous doing this?
I found it a matter of a bit of concern. However, I realized that this had to be done, and so we taxied down to this hotel. The agents identified themselves and their credentials to the assistant manager of the hotel, who led us to a room. This room was essentially empty except for a table and a steel cabinet against the wall, which was opened. I think perhaps he opened it with a key. The cabinet itself was empty, except on one of the lower shelves was a package, a box, a rectangular box of ordinary size, which was wrapped in brown wrapping paper. It turned out to be a highly polished box with brass clasps, and it looked more like an instrument case. And after waiting a while and listening a while and remembering that it had been there for quite a few years, I think it had actually been there for about 5 years as a security, I opened it. My report to Dr. Compton was that I saw no danger in releasing these papers and these relics to his heirs.
Miss Musar had arrived too late to know who had opened Dr. Tesla's safe or what had been removed. And Dr. Trump had found nothing which he considered dangerous or a secret weapon. Tesla had been a naturalized American citizen for 54 years, so why were his papers seized by agents of the custodian of alien property? I suspect that governments other than those of the United States, England, and Russia were interested in the inventions of Dr. Tesla.
Indeed, governments other than the United States, England, and Russia were interested, as this was 1943, at the height of World War II, and the most technologically advanced nation in the world at the time was Germany. While it's a fact that Germany did not win the war, it's also a fact that military expeditions continued immediately following the official end of the war, such as Operation High Jump, which was a literal invasion of what was an allegedly German military base in Antarctica that was rumored to house Germany's most advanced technology, as well as the last battalion of the SS, which never surrendered in 1945. While there are those that question the speculation regarding Operation High Jump, they are often the same people that question the Battle of Los Angeles in 1942, where disc-shaped craft hovered above the west coast of the United States for hours, or the alleged disc-shaped craft that crashed in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947, or the disc-shaped craft that, according to national press, outran jets and flew over the White House with impunity in 1952.
Well, actually, what this booklet does, it discusses a great many of these sightings around Washington, D.C., particularly those of mid-July 1952, when about a dozen of the things came over. About a dozen of them came over one night. They were tracked by radar. They were seen visually. They followed the planes in, and according to the CAA's own booklet, the pilots got good looks at the things as they followed them in and out of the airport. Some of them hovered. Some of them went around the Capitol building. Some went over the monument and the White House and over the deep freeze and circled all around there. They were seen plainly. There was no question about them being there. And as a matter of fact, the officials were so concerned about it that on the following morning, they issued a shoot 'em down order. Why didn't they shoot 'em down the first night? They didn't shoot 'em down because the jets couldn't catch them, and they've never been able to catch one yet. The jets couldn't catch them. The next night they showed up, the jets didn't go up after them. They didn't go up with their shoot 'em down order for the simple reason that Alfred Einstein and others of comparable standing heard about the shoot 'em down order, because the story was on the front pages all over the world. They heard about this shoot 'em down order, and they personally got in touch with the little man in the White House, and I know what Mr. Einstein told him. He said, "Mr. President, anyone who can cross millions of miles of space will be able to take care of himself after he gets there. Don't start something you can't finish." That was one time that Give 'em Hell Harry decided it would be better not to give 'em any hell.
The official word from the U.S. government regarding flying saucers at the time was either that they were weather balloons or aliens from another planet. The idea being that they could control both sides of the story, whether people believed that they were real or fake, as long as they did not suspect that they originated on Earth, especially by German nationalists that they could not defeat, whose technology would make the Rockefeller energy sector monopoly obsolete. While these craft posed a national security threat, the threat of free energy was arguably of greater concern, as it directly challenged big oil and their stranglehold on the world economy. I've covered what happens next in several prior videos, especially on my other channel, including the following clip that I'd like to include in this presentation, which explores an alternative mathematics, which Tesla himself was aware of, and could hold keys to freeing mankind from those that would prefer to enslave it. A vortex is most commonly defined as a mass of whirling fluid or air, especially a whirlpool or whirlwind, in which the flow rotates around an axis line. So it's a mass of something that spins around and pulls objects down into its center, or when the spin around the center draws the outside in. That's a vortex. And math is often defined as the science of numbers, quantities, and shapes, and the relations between them. So vortex-based mathematics can be understood as a new way of understanding numbers, not just as mere quantities, but where each has its own unique quality, archetype, and behavior. While several mainstream sources have denounced this idea, calling it New Age pseudo-math, the truth is that this alternative form of mathematics is not new at all, and actually is quite ancient, with similar concepts having been found etched on Babylonian clay tablets dating back several millennia. This non-linear, holistic view of math was also revered by none other than Nikola Tesla, who famously stated that, quote, "If you knew the magnificence of the 3, 6, and 9, you would have a key to the universe," end quote. Tesla believed that numbers had extreme importance, and so did the ancient Greek philosopher Pythagoras, who around 500 BC was famously quoted as saying, "All is number." The basic principle of vortex math is that all numbers can be reduced down to single digits, from 1 to 9, and this form of reduction is common in many forms of occult practices, commonly referred to as numerology, which is any belief in the divine or mystical relationship between a number and one or more coinciding events. It's also the study of the numerical value of letters in words, names, and ideas, and often associated with astrology or Kabbalah, where letters are assigned a numeric value. That said, the process of reducing a number down to one digit, between 1 and 9, is also common practice not only in numerology, but also in mainstream science, such as with computer programming. So, for example, a number such as 12 would be reduced to 3 by adding 1 plus 2. The number 10 would be reduced to 1 by adding 1 plus 0. The number 99, for example, would be reduced by adding 9 plus 9, making 18, and further reduced by adding 1 plus 8, giving us 9. Understanding this principle, let us now apply this number 1 through 9 to a circle, a concept that was made famous in modern times by a gentleman named Marco Rodin, but which, as I said earlier, is actually very ancient. Notice the lines in the center, which resemble the Volkswagen logo, and the special relationship between 3, 6, and 9, which we will get into later. Let us start with the number 1. When we double the number 1, we get the number 2, which is connected here with a line. When we double the number 2, we get the number 4. When we double the number 4, we get the number 8. Doubling the number 8 gives us 16. And since 16 is a double digit, we reduce it by adding 1 and 6, giving us the number 7, which, as you can see, is connected to the number 8 by a line. Doubling 16, we get the number 32. And after reducing 32 by adding the 3 and the 2, we get 5, which is the next number connected to the 7. When we double 32, we get 64. We then reduce that by adding the 6 and the 4, which gives us 10. So we reduce that by adding the 1 and the 0, leaving us with 1. And we're back where we started. So there's a parallel between 64 and 1, when it becomes whole again, or a single unit. This is why 64 is the complete cycle for the Mayan calendar, or the I Ching. Also, there are 64 possible patterns for a codon in DNA. This doubling, or geometric progression, is commonly found in nature, and was understood by the ancients. Now, if we go backwards, meaning reduce the number 1 by half, we would get 0.5, which translates to 5. If we reduce 0.5 in half, we get 0.25. And after adding the 2 and 5, it leaves us with 7. Reducing 0.25 in half gives us 0.125. And adding 1 plus 2 plus 5 gives us 8. Reducing 0.125 in half gives us 0.0625. And adding 0 plus 6 plus 2 plus 5 leaves us with 13. And adding 1 and 3 gives us the number 4. Half of 0.0625 is 0.03125. And adding 0 plus 3 plus 1 plus 2 plus 5 gives us 11. Reducing 11 by adding 1 plus 1 leaves us with the number 2. And finally, half of 0.03125 is 0.015625. And 0 plus 1 plus 5 plus 6 plus 2 plus 5 equals 19. 1 plus 9 equals 10, and 1 plus 0 gets us right back to 1 and where we started. This cycle of doubling each number, or reducing each number by half, works with any variation of the number you start with. So for example, if you start with 100 instead of 1, and reduce it in half, or double it, and follow the procedure we just did, you will find it works out perfectly. You may have also noticed that the pattern skipped the numbers 3, 6, and 9, the numbers that Nikola Tesla said were the key to the universe. When the number 3 is doubled, we get the number 6. When 6 is doubled, we get 12. And 1 plus 2 is 3. 12 doubled becomes 24. And 2 plus 4 is 6. 24 doubled is 48. And 4 plus 8 is 12, with 1 plus 2 bringing us back to 3. 48 doubled is 96, and 9 plus 6 is 15, with 1 plus 5 giving us 6. So no matter how often you double the 3 and the 6, or half them, you will find the oscillating back and forth between each other. Half of 6 is 3, half of 3 is 1.5, and 1 plus 5 is 6. Any variation will work. Half of 30 is 15. And again, 1 plus 5 gives us 6. So there's a very special relationship between 3 and 6. A back and forth cycle, which none of the other numbers share. This finally brings us to the number 9, which is also sacred in Taoism. And we will now see why. What happens when we double the number 9? 9 becomes 18, and 1 plus 8 is 9. 18 doubled is 36, and 3 plus 6 is 9. 36 doubled is 72, and 7 plus 2 is 9. This goes on indefinitely. What happens when we half 9? Half of 9 is 4.5, and 4 plus 5 equals 9. Half of 4.5 is 2.25, and 2 plus 2 plus 5 is 9. So 9 is very unique, and while all the numbers are special in their own respect, 9 is the only one with this property, and why it is the center, forming the axis in the middle. This is further illustrated when we look at each set of numbers on each side of the circle equaling 9. 8 plus 1 is 9. 7 plus 2 is 9. 6 plus 3 is 9. And 5 plus 4 is 9. So 9 is in the middle. It separates and polarizes the numbers, turning the other numbers into a sort of mirror image, or right and left, or a positive and negative. Two sides of a coin, so to speak. Two halves of a whole. Now, when we take away the trinity of 3, 6, and 9, we are left with six numbers, the 1, 2, 4, 8, 7, and 5. And esoterically speaking, these six make up the physical world of creation, the pattern that is repeated in physicality, the underlying geometry of the material world, which is essentially hexagonal. And this can be seen in nature, such as in the formation of crystals or in snowflakes. 3, 6, and 9 seem to transcend the physical and are therefore considered part of the higher world, which give them special applications in terms of physics and even religion or spirituality. The Roden coil is a three-dimensional toroidal shape with this vortex math attached to it, where alternating current is run through a loop, creating a very strong magnetic field inside of the coil. When magnetic objects are placed in the center of the coil, the magnetic field created by the coil causes the magnets to rotate and even levitate. There are many claims made about this simple geometric shape, essentially made from copper wire, coiled in a specific way, such as being able to produce free energy, or at least greatly amplifying energy. There are also many skeptics. That said, Tesla's work also had many skeptics, most of it buried under government classification, but that doesn't mean it wasn't valid or useful. Scientists now accept that a material universe as the foundation of what we perceive to be our physical material world isn't quite the case. Today, physicists recognize that physical atoms are actually made up of vortices of energy that are constantly spinning and vibrating. At its smallest observable level, matter is energy, and this energy that exists all around us can be tapped into and potentially used to generate power. Quantum physics has left many scientists baffled. If quantum mechanics hasn't profoundly shocked you, you haven't understood it yet. Everything we call real is made up of things that cannot be regarded as real. Spiritual concepts of our ancient world are directly intertwined with modern-day science, and especially quantum physics, and Nikola Tesla was well aware of this. All perceptible matter comes from a primary substance, or tenuity beyond conception, filling all space, the Akasha or luminiferous ether, which is acted upon by the life-giving prana or creative force, calling into existence in never-ending cycles all things and phenomena. As you can see, Tesla was aware of ancient concepts and correlations it had with the science he was working on, using Sanskrit words like Akasha and prana to describe the force and matter that exists all around us. These words come from ancient Aryan or Vedic texts. Another term for prana is chi in the Far East, or ether in certain occult or alchemical circles, and vril in esoteric European secret societies. This subtle bioelectromagnetic life force energy was said to be available throughout the universe and could allegedly be harnessed and redirected into a free energy technology. Before many generations pass, our machinery will be driven by a power obtainable at any point in the universe. This idea is not novel. We find it in the delightful myth of Antheus, who derives power from the earth. We find it among subtle speculations of one of your splendid mathematicians. Throughout space, there is energy. Is this energy static or kinetic? If static, our hopes are in vain. If kinetic, and this we know it is, for certain, then it is a mere question of time when men will succeed in attaching their machinery to the very wheel work of nature. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your comments, so please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.